All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship. If anything happened, somebody stabbed you in the back, say, on break, and you need to rebound, now's the time to handle that. Spit on your shoes, something minor, something major. All right, let's continue on here. We see Solomon's conclusion in point 23. And point 24 is where we're ready to begin. If a man does these two things, he becomes the type of person that is in good, rather in God's sight, which forms the basis for true blessing in life. Again, we saw that in the initial stages where Solomon sort of began to kind of interject some of the divine viewpoint of life into this. In verse 26 here, to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. Again, the intangibles that make life worth living isn't the things that people are looking for out there. Success, fame, money, fortune, all these types of things that people think are going to satisfy them. It is the intangibles in life that God provides. Not to say that he doesn't provide the others as well, because he does, is the source of other blessing as well. But these things are far more important than how much money you make, where you live, who you know, how famous you are, and all of that type of thing. Because the fact is, at a certain level, to be real honest with you, it doesn't matter what you do, you're going to die. So, I mean, let's just face it, there isn't any way you're going to get out of here alive, absent the rapture. So should you use good judgment? That becomes, I guess, a question. Okay, should I use good judgment in life since really, seriously, it doesn't matter, I'm going to die anyway. So why not just use bad judgment? That would be one logical question a person could ask. But bad judgment brings a lot of other things with it. It brings discipline, it brings misery. And again, we try to keep a balance. As Paul told Timothy, bodily exercise is profitable for a little while, but let me tell you something. The finely tuned athlete's going to die, just as the fat, pudgy person is going to die. And the one who never does one exercise, couldn't do a jumping jack to save their soul, is going to die. And the one who can run a marathon and win is going to die. It doesn't make any difference. As a matter of fact, there was an article this week. There was a story up at, I believe it was Central Florida. And finely tuned athlete, 19 years old, prime of life, boom, drops over dead. So people are out there worried about saccharin and artificial sweeteners, and 19-year-olds are dropping dead in the prime of their life. I don't think it was saccharin that killed him. I'll bet you money that it wasn't. So again, is one wise to use good judgment and to think through things and to try to do things that are, you know, enable health? Because bodily exercise is profitable for a little while. But that little while is only while you're alive. And that life is going to end. So again, point 25 here, as Solomon has observed, sometimes righteous men do not appear to reap the benefits of being righteous, while wicked men do not appear to suffer for their wickedness. 26, the righteous man deals with the type of person that is oriented to God, who lives his life in an honorable way before God and alongside his fellow man. And this gets into principles of living with your fellow man as much as it lies with you. Try to be at peace with all people. You live your life in an honorable way. You don't break the laws. You are establishment oriented and all that. 27, righteousness would include the concept of being a law-abiding citizen. That's part of righteousness. In phase two would be obeying the laws of the land, as well as acting with justice and equity towards others. You want to try to do the right things. You want to be a righteous person. You want to be a just person. At some points, again, as much as possible, you try to live at peace with everybody. 28, while the New American Standard has understood this passage in terms of life and death, it may include suffering in phase two, as well as physical death. When he talks about here, there is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness. Again, it's not as though he dies. He may just lose his position. He might be righteous, and in spite of the fact he's righteous, he suffers. He is mistreated, demoted, for whatever reason, because circumstances didn't look good. I've had that happen to me. You know, you have things happen in life, and you look at it at the time, it's not necessarily pleasant. But as you look back on it, you realize, okay, well, this is true. You could be a righteous person, you could do the right thing, and you can be accused of all manner of things. And if you can't, you know, at some level, it's not really even up to you to defend yourself. This is the deal. See the doctrine of vindication. And the key deal in the doctrine of vindication is you don't pursue vindication. You let God vindicate you. And so you can do the right thing. Inevitably, something can happen. Some little thing that you have no control over. And boom, then, you know, suddenly you're suffering. So it happens to people. It does. People suffer righteous, bad things happen to them. It can happen in life at any point. So that might, you know, again, so then people want to take this and run off to the extreme. Well, then it doesn't matter. And that is, at some level, what Solomon will deal with here. So 29, in that regard, Solomon may simply be speaking of his career, his position in life, his reputation, which can be destroyed in spite of his integrity. I was earlier in my life on a job where I was accused of pilfering money. And so I, you know, got fired. But did I take the money? No, didn't. Somebody, one of my nice friends at the time, figured out, you know, that I would have had to been stealing on the order of 3 cents a day over the course of this time in order to get this amount of money that was missing. I'm pretty subtle. I'll never miss these 2 cents a day. You steal 2 cents a day for 50 years. Well, what do you got? Well, at the end of each year, you got about $7.20. And for 50 years, you'd have, you know, $350. But, you know, I wasn't stealing pennies. But the point is, it can happen. Whether you do wrong or not, you can be accused of doing wrong. Doesn't make any difference. It happens in life. And so Solomon recognized it happens in life. So 30, in the worst case scenario, the righteous man dies in spite of his righteousness. And the wicked man is able to extend his career or life in some way. 8:12, where Solomon says, although a sinner does evil 100 times. And again, they supply length in his life because they're dealing in life and death. But I would say length in his position. Or even strengthen his position, depends on, you know, what his situation is in life. But he's able to advance himself still. Still, I know that it will be well for those who fear God, who fear him openly. So 31, the inseparable preposition bait here, which is prefixed to the Hebrew word tzedek, righteousness, is to be understood in a concessive manner. These types of things can happen in spite of the fact that he is upright. And 32, on the other hand, Solomon cites his second case history as he acknowledges that he has observed those that are wicked. 33, while those that are righteous express right attitudes and conduct toward God and man, the rasha, the wicked, are those types of people who demonstrate ethical attitudes or do not rather demonstrate ethical attitudes or conduct toward God or man. So some people are flagrant about it. Some people are more subtle about it. Some people give lip service to God, all the while demonstrating unethical attitudes. You never know. You have to observe people, and the proof is in the pudding. And as you watch them, you can figure out, okay, are they giving lip service to doctrine, or are they really following it? So 34, nevertheless, Solomon has observed these types of people prolonging themselves in life, maintaining their position, status, reputation, etc., and even life, in spite of the fact that they are hostile to God and man. At a certain level, the rasha doesn't concern himself with pleasing God or dealing honorably with his fellow man. And 35, since they cannot control God, it would seem that they use their power to oppress others and insulate themselves from the judgment that is due to them. And certain people are good at this. They are practiced at this ability to make others take the fall when they themselves are the guilty ones, and all that. Well, that's inappropriate. Okay, so the question here now becomes, and I posed this with a question mark, the golden mean, which is a doctrine of life that essentially states, is this what Solomon's advocating, is the question here. Is a doctrine of life that essentially states, don't be too good and don't be too bad. Take the middle road in life. Don't be overly righteous and don't be overly wicked. Verse 16, do not be excessively righteous. and do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? A negative ale here with a cal imperfect jussive of hayah. The negative ale, again, this construct is normally used as construction to forbid an activity already in progress stop being excessively righteous. But again, every time I've seen him use this construction in the book, it always shades into a permanent prohibition as far as I can tell. I don't see anything to suggest that he's saying, well, stop being excessively righteous now, but later on you can be. I think it's permanent, but even though he uses this construction intentionally to tell people, if you're doing it, stop it now. Stop becoming, hayah is the verb. Stop becoming, or do not become, excessively. A righteous is actually the masculine singular adjective you've got here. Tzadik, T-S-A-D-I-Y-Q. Just or lawful or righteous, equitable is the idea of it. And then the hifil infinitive absolute here functions as an adverb, overly wise. Or actually it functions as an adjective, excessively wise. Don't keep becoming excessively wise, or stop becoming excessively wise. And then you have a similar construction. You got a wow and. Then the negative ale here, the hippial infinitive absolute, by the way, is rabah, R-A-B-H-A-H. Excessively, to be great, much, or many. The hippial is causative, to cause to be great. Then you have a wow plus the negative ale plus the hippial imperfect of kakan. C-H-A-K-H-A-N. Kakam, the verb here, again, the hifil imperfect. The jussive is, it's not a distinct form. The form is the imperfect. The jussive is just essentially used of commands. The imperfect is used in a command rather than the imperative. And that's common in Hebrew. You see that often enough, that the imperfect can be used in commands. You will not do thus and such. It has the force of a command, even though it's an imperfect. So, again, this means to make, show, or demonstrate oneself to be wise. Now, some interpreters suggest here this means to feign wisdom, to put on a pretense. Don't present yourself as too wise, meaning that you're really stupid, but you're just faking it. But the word doesn't mean that. It means exactly what it says it means here. And then you have the masculine singular noun of yother, Y-O-T-H-E-R. That which is left over, and that which is in excess, that which is too much or more than you need. So they've translated overly, excessively righteous and overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? The interrogative particle here is actually the prefix lamed with ma. For what, literally? And they translate why for English is better. Why would you ruin yourself? And you have here an interesting word. This is a hithpolel. Of shamim, S-H-A-M-E-M. Shamim, the cow means to be desolated or destroyed, and it usually means something that is destroyed from some judgment, and generally it's used of divine judgment. The polel and the hith polel stems extend the meaning to include inner devastation, i.e. how one feels when one observes a devastation. Like if you see something destroyed, you know, what's that inner attitude you have, the inner emotion that's conjured up when you see a horrible destruction? The idea means to be ashamed, astonished, shocked, or confounded in these stems. And so it's not so much ruin yourself as it is to confound your own self. You're making a big mistake if you pursue this course in life, he would say. Why? Well, because number one, you're never going to achieve perfect righteousness or perfect wisdom. So you're always going to be let down in this process. And if you make this your life's work, getting excessively wise and excessively righteous, so much so that you just look down on everybody because you're so much wiser and more righteous than they are. Well, first, you're never going to get there. And all you're going to do is destroy yourself mentally in some way. So verse 17, do not be excessively wicked, and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? Again, negative ale plus the cal imperfect jussive of Rasha, This word means to do or act wickedly, to be wrong or unjust. Same hifil infinitive absolute of rava, again, excessively, to a great degree. A while plus the negative ale again, and stop becoming a fool. Again, these all shade into, while immediate prohibition would be the force, I don't see any reason not to take these as permanent prohibitions as well. Stop becoming is haya again. Do not become a kasa. A sakal, I'm sorry. S-A-K-H-A-L. Got my radicals mixed up there. Sakal. A one who is lacking morally or spiritually. Now, a fool, again, is not a person who's intellectually deficient. A fool is a person with a propensity to make wrong choices. And the fool gets into the type of person that inevitably comes down on the wrong side of something. If there's an issue, he'll be on the wrong side of it. Now, that's the nature of the fool. And again, probably that perfect fool out there doesn't exist, because if he did, he'd be dead. He'd be so stupid, he'd constantly make so many bad choices that he'd never survive. So you have levels of foolishness. Everything from the complete and utter fool, we might say, to the person that makes the occasional. We all make occasional bad choices. We all make occasional foolish choices. But we're talking about a person with a propensity for it, that they'll make one bad choice after another that'll eventually lead them down a path of destruction. We may make bad choices. At least at this point, we're not on the path of destruction. And so obviously, it's things in life is to make good choices. We should. But we all occasionally fail. That's why we have rebound. And we can recover, correct ourselves, and move on. So again, don't be a fool. Now, the one thing here that you should notice is that all these others are qualified by adjectives. Excessively righteous, overly wise, excessively wicked. The fool is not qualified by anything. He doesn't think any kind of foolishness is good. It's not just too much foolishness, it's any. Don't be a fool. Why should you die before your time? And again, interrogative particle, lama, lamed with the ma. For what or why? Cal imperfect of muth. Will you die? Now here he actually gets into the subject of life and death, physical death. Why will you die? And then you have the inseparable preposition bait here with the negative lo. And it can be translated in a number of ways, but here the best translation would be before. Before your time is the common singular noun, F-E-T-H, with the second masculine singular suffix. A similar construction Joe's used there in Job 15:32, where it's also translated, it will be accomplished before his time. And this verse brings up an interesting concept in Ecclesiastes and in the concept of wisdom literature, and that was that it was accepted as a part of the wisdom tradition that God killed people before their time sometimes. That they would bring, and again, the question becomes, one has to ask, now does God kill them, or do their stupid choices kill them? You know, you can make some again, we all make foolish choices from time to time. We all do dumb stuff. I mean, you wouldn't want to get up here and have to list all the dumb things you've done in your life. But again, if you're positive, one, God protects you at a certain level in spite of your own stupidity. Now, if you go negative, all bets are off at some level. And God won't necessarily protect you, but he does protect the righteous. So here, verse 32, it will be accomplished before his time, and the palm branch will not be green. One of the contentions is, and again, does God kill the person who makes foolish choices, or does his own bad choices kill him? Again, jumping off the Skyway Bridge with bungee cords. If you fall and die, who killed the person? Did God or did his own stupidity? Well, one could argue for both cases, I would guess, since God does control life and death. It is good that you grasp one thing and also not let go of the other. For the one who fears God comes forth with both of them. Good, it is good. Supply the to-be verb here. It is good. Masculine singular, a noun, tov, T-O-V-H. It is good, which, or actually in this case, that is a better translation, and this is a legitimate translation for the relative particle I share. It is good that you, cal imperfect, second masculine singular, akaz, A-C-H-A-Z, This means to take hold of something, to grasp. Obviously, in a physical sense, you pick up something with your hand. In a mental sense, it means to grasp something, to mentally comprehend it or understand it. The idea here, it's better that you comprehend one thing. It's better that you learn with this inseparable preposition bait plus the adjective zeh, Z-E-H. I.e., the near demonstrative adjective zeh would refer to the advice of verse 17. It's good that you take this advice. It's good that you learn from this or comprehend this. That you shouldn't be excessively wicked and you shouldn't be a fool. And also, as the adjective, the adverb gam, also indeed or even, and even from that preposition men, it also uses the near demonstrative zeh. But when you have zeh used in sequence like this, it's usually translated this and that, or one and the other. So in this context, it would refer to the more remote piece of advice, that which is in verse 16. It's good that you figure out verse 17, but it's also good that you figure out verse 16 or comprehend it and make it your own. Also, not let go of the other. And also from the other, literally, as they've translated it. The one thing is the way they translated zeh here. And the other thing. The one piece of advice, again, verse 17, and the other piece of advice, verse 16. And the other piece of advice, negative ale, again, with a hifil jussive, force, nuach, N-U-A-C-H. Again, this has the form of an immediate prohibition. And not let go. The hifil here, the word nuach is where we get the name Noah comes from, in fact. The verb means to rest or to be settled down in a position with the overtones of finality. The hifil means to cause to be settled down, to cause to rest. And when it's used with the hand, which it is here, you got the sign of the direct object plus the feminine singular noun of yad, plus the second masculine singular suffix, to rest the hand, i.e. to relax your grip on something, is the nuance of it. So it's good that you comprehend the one thing, but not let your grip go on the first piece of advice. There needs to be a balance here at some level. Now the question again becomes, is he advocating moderate righteousness and moderate wickedness? And if he is, how righteous should I be and how wicked should I be? I mean, what can I get away with? That's the big question, right? Not how righteous should I be, but what can I really get away with? That would be normal human nature. But the one, or for the one here, you got a conjunction here. They viewed it as explanatory. It might almost be adversative. But the one who fears God, masculine singular noun construct of Yareh, Y-A-R-E, apostrophe. This means a fearer of, it's a construct, a fearer of Elohim. A fearer of Elohim will come out or depart or escape. Cal imperfect, third masculine singular of Yatsah. Y-A-T-S-A, apostrophe. He will come out or go out or depart or escape from these all, literally, or all these. And they've translated it, both of them. You got the sign of the direct object with the masculine singular noun of kol, all of them. Third masculine plural suffix. All, these are four extremes in a sense. Perfect righteousness, that's an extreme. Perfect wisdom, that's an extreme. Perfect wickedness, extreme. Foolishness, that's an extreme. And the one who figures certain things out, he says, will escape from these extremes. He will not be taken in by it. Okay, exposition, we got a lot to say and deal with here, obviously. Point one, there is little doubt that the advice that is offered in verses 16 and 17 flows directly from the observation that Solomon made in verse 15. Verse 15 provides the foundation for the warnings against the extreme behaviors of verses 16 and 17. Why not be overly righteous? Well, Because he's seen that the righteous can perish in spite of the fact that they're righteous. So there comes a point at which an inordinate pursuit of righteousness, it becomes counterproductive. Just as there comes a point at which an inordinate pursuit of wisdom becomes counterproductive. We would say the pursuit of wickedness is counterproductive in the first place. And folly is counterproductive in the first place. To a cursory reading of these verses would seem to indicate that Solomon is advocating what many have referred to as the golden mean, which is an ideology in which moderation is prescribed as the ideal way to live one's life. And generally speaking, we might say moderation is a good way to live life, but is it always a good way to live life? No, not necessarily. There are times that call for extreme actions. There are times that call for extreme measures. Moderation is of no value in those times. That was one of the things I saw in this new miniseries that was on about John Adams. Him and Benjamin Franklin were butting heads consistently because Franklin was a politician, more of a politician than Adams was. And Adams said, these times call for something more than just a political commentary sitting around a table. These times call for action. And Franklin was like, you're going to alienate the French with this constant call for action. The French aren't necessarily into action. They're more into drinking wine and having parties and being genteel. So they would, you know, Adams accompanied him to France, and they butted heads consistently because Adams was speaking his mind about this is the time for action. And Franklin was like, let's drink some wine and enjoy the French. Because we, you know, but he was going through the diplomatic process, but Adams didn't have time for the diplomatic process. Men were dying, and so he was not of the mind that we've got time to negotiate here. So sometimes moderation isn't what's called for. Sometimes it is, so one would have to figure out, of course, is this the best way? Now, and the golden mean is prescribed as the ideal way to live life. Now, is this the ideal way? Becomes the question. Three, the same cursory reading certainly tends to indicate that Solomon is dealing with opposite extremes in these first two verses. This is seen in his contrast between righteousness and wickedness and between the wise man and the fool. For since Solomon has just observed that the righteous man may be destroyed in spite of his righteousness and that the wicked may prosper in spite of his wickedness, one might naturally reason that righteousness and wickedness do not really determine the outcome of one's life. That would be the natural conclusion off of that verse. Righteous people suffer, wicked people prosper. So, what should I do? Does it serve me to be righteous? Maybe a little wickedness, not a bad thing. Might work out. Well, five, however, Solomon is dealing with the realities of what we see under the sun, as opposed to what we expect from God's government. Therefore, one would make a critical error to suggest that life should be lived by the anomalies. Again, these are the exceptions to the rule. Even Solomon would probably, if you could quiz him, I would assume he would acknowledge, well, yeah, these are the exceptions to the rule. I've seen righteous people suffer, and I've seen wicked people prosper. Is this the norm? Probably not, but it does happen. And that's what, again, in this book, Solomon deals with these difficult things that a lot of people like to gloss over. Oh, that doesn't happen. Yes, it does. It does happen. And when it does happen, it challenges your faith. Well, why did this happen? I was a righteous person, and this happened to me. And look at the people out there pursuing unrighteousness, and they're successful. So again, this challenges the believer. What value is there in being righteous, in doing the right thing? Well, 6, verse 16 is constructed of two negative justive forms. Essentially, these are imperatives. Followed by a question that begins with lama, and that is for what reason or why. 7, normally the construction that employs the negative ale with the imperfect of the verb is used for immediate prohibition. This is designed to stop an action that should be an action in progress. That spell checker just can't figure out grammar. an action in progress and would be translated, stop becoming overly righteous. If you're pursuing this, quit it, he would say. 8, throughout this book, however, the same construction has been used and would seem to extend to the realm of permanent prohibition. And this would be translated, permanent would be never seek to be overly righteous. 9, the first problem with this prohibition is how it is to be understood. And 10, there are two main interpretations that have been advanced, depending upon how the interpreter views Solomon's piety and orthodoxy. If Solomon's a godly believer, given sound advice, and if he's an orthodox believer, adhering to the wisdom tradition, it's one thing. If Solomon is an idiot offering this advice, it's quite another thing. And so one has to look at Solomon and think, ask himself this question, how do I perceive Solomon in order to deal with this statement that he's made? And is Solomon advocating what he actually believes? I mean, does he really believe this? He's saying it. Does he believe it? Because we've pointed out at certain times in this book that Solomon engages in illogical stuff that you've got to be able to figure out, wait a minute, that's not logical. It doesn't follow logically. And see the flaws in his thinking. That's the challenge in this book, is Solomon records his whole experiment and various facets of it, gives you his thinking through the process, and doesn't necessarily comment on whether or not he thinks it's right or wrong. He's honest about it and says, this is the way I felt. This is what I thought. And does it mean he thinks that now? That becomes a question. Have you ever thought anything earlier in your life that you don't think now? You've probably grown through certain things and say, oh, I don't think the same way I did 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So again, depending upon how one views Solomon, is going to, in large measure, depend on how one is going to determine how one interprets this. 11, the first suggests that Solomon is warning against seeking righteousness and wisdom with some excessive fervor. The second suggests he is warning against pretending to be more righteous and wise than you actually are. 12, the alternate view is largely based on the Hithpiel stem of Kakam. To make oneself wise or to show oneself wise in the second prohibition. That second view there is based on, in fact, it's based on a misinterpretation of this word, is what the second view is based on. So that probably ought to tell you which one's right. It's the first view. Which some simply interpret as simply pretending to be wise. 13, although the Hithpiel of this verb is used one other time in the Old Testament, and it clearly means to be wise or act wisely, it does not mean to feign wisdom. And it's used in Exodus 1:10. And so here we have, this is a fundamental rule of interpretation, by the way, in part of hermeneutics, is the clear usage interprets the obscure usage. The clear verse interprets the obscure verse. And here we have a clear usage of the Hithpiel of Kakam and what it means. Exodus 1:10. And here is the new king that arose over Egypt. And he says, come now. And he's talking about the sons of Israel are more and more powerful than we are. We're outnumbered and they're stronger. Let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply, and in the event of war they will join themselves to those who hate us. So does this mean let's pretend we're wise? Or does it mean we better develop a wise course of action here and go with it? And it clearly means that. And that's the only other usage of the Hithpiel of Kakam in the Old Testament. So that's the clear usage. It means to be wise or to act wisely. So that verse, to me, nails what Solomon is saying here. He's not saying don't pretend to be wise. He's saying don't be overly wise. Don't pursue wisdom with too much intensity. Why? Why would he say that? Well, if you look at the end of, the end of chapter 8 of Ecclesiastes, why would he say don't try to be overly wise? Why? Because he's already been through this himself. He's already concluded you're not going to figure it all out anyway. Ecclesiastes 8:17. And I saw every work of God, and I concluded that man cannot discover the work that has been done under the sun. Even though man should seek laboriously, he will not discover. And even though the wise man should say, I've got it figured out, he cannot discover. And so Solomon already knows there's a certain limitation to wisdom that you're going to encounter. And even if you are wise, wisdom isn't always a guarantee of success, is it? No, it's not. So what is he saying here? Well, 14, additionally, given what verse 17 says about those that are wicked and fools dying before their time, it becomes evident that he is talking about reality and not pretense in both of these verses. He's not saying don't pretend to be wicked or don't pretend to be a fool. He's saying don't be overly wicked and don't be a fool. And in this verse, he's saying don't be overly righteous and don't be overly wise. So we're talking about realities here, not just pretenses. Solomon's not saying don't fake it. That's not what he's saying. 15, it must be noted that Solomon is not telling people not to be righteous, which not only conflicts with his view of the fact that God is for the righteous, it violates the tenor of the Bible as a whole. Ecclesiastes 9:1, for instance, later on he's going to say, I have taken all this to my heart, and I explain it that righteous men, wise men, and their deeds are in the hand of God. That at a certain level, even if you're righteous and even if you're wise, certain control over your life doesn't belong to you, it belongs to God. And man does not know whether it will be love or hatred. Anything awaits him. You don't know what tomorrow's going to bring. You can't be clear. The person you love and trust the most could turn on you in a heartbeat. Just like that. And you could be righteous, you could be wise. It won't make any difference, will it? No, it really truly won't. Also, Psalm 5:12. Well, you can see these verses. We've actually looked up many of these already earlier. That God is for the righteous. Psalm 5:12, 11:7, 34:16. Let's look up the first, or 34:15. 1 Samuel 26 also. Here's David's words. The Lord will repay each man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. And here's where he's telling Saul, the Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I refuse to stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. David understood the concept of authority and that God had placed this man there and that he was not going to be the one who was going to go after him. Even though, in this case, David could have killed him. David had him dead to rights. David, his conscience struck him. He had a guilty conscience over this, even that he cut off, the edge of his garment was all he did. To prove to Saul, I had you. But even his conscience bothered him because he said, this wasn't right. I shouldn't have done this. It's not up to me to try to take down the authorities. That's not my plan. That's not God's plan for my life. David was really squared away on that one. Also, Matthew 6:33, of course, which is the command to seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness and all of that. The tenor of the Bible as a whole suggests that righteousness is the way God goes. And it's the way the believer ought to go. So, is Solomon telling people not to be righteous? Clearly not. That's not what he's getting at here by any stretch of the imagination. Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. And Matthew 13:43. And again, I could have cited a lot of verses. I try to just give you a few to point out that it's true. Then the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. That righteousness is going to be rewarded in phase three. Of that, there is no question. So why would he tell believers don't be righteous? Well, he wouldn't. That's not what he's getting at. 16, what he is warning against is the excessive pursuit of righteousness that goes beyond what God actually requires and beyond what any man is capable of attaining. 17, as Solomon will point out, there is a limit to what man can achieve in terms of righteousness and wisdom. Ecclesiastes there, 7:20. He'll point out that there's, first, he's going to tell you, there isn't a perfectly righteous man and you're never going to find one. Indeed, there is not a righteous man on the earth who continually does good and who never sins. And the sin, the idea of sin, that word kata, means to miss the mark. Everybody misses the mark. Even the most righteous person in the world is going to let you down from time to time. It's just the way it is. You have to be willing to accept that and deal with it in this imperfect world. Further, his point is that acquiring either does not provide any guarantee in this life. He just said that in verse 15. That righteousness doesn't always win out. Wickedness sometimes prospers. He'll say it in 8:14. There is a futility which is done on the earth. That is, there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. On the other hand, there are evil men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I say this is a vanity. This is futility. This is empty. And also 9:11, he'll point it out again. Here in a different tone, but the idea is the same. I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift. In other words, the fastest guy doesn't always win the race. And the battle is not to the warriors. The biggest, strongest guy doesn't always win the fight, i.e. Goliath. Should David have had a chance in hell against him that day? No. Goliath was a professional soldier. David was a shepherd. Goliath was about 9.5 feet tall. David was 5 foot nothing in his heels. You know, he was short. And Goliath was no doubt in good shape. I mean, his spear weighed more than David could probably have picked up and thrown. And yet, the battle didn't go to the strong that day. Didn't go to the warrior. It went to the shepherd. That's the amazing thing. And neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability. For time and chance overtake them all. And you really don't know what's coming on you. And one of the things you don't know is what time in history men aren't cognizant many times of where they are in human history. And they don't know what's about to unfold. Moreover, man does not know his time. Like fish caught in a treacherous net, and men are ensnared in an evil time when it suddenly falls on them. Do you think the first Advent generation knew that Jerusalem was going down in 70 AD as part of God's judgment on them for rejecting Messiah? I don't think they knew that. Now, they could have been clear on it. The prophecies were there, but I don't think they knew it. Again, they weren't oriented to the doctrine. So, again, Solomon points out there's a limit to what you can achieve, and even if you got it, let's assume you get it. Let's assume you're righteous and wise. There's no guarantees of anything in this life anyway, that anything could happen. Life is an uncertain crapshoot sometimes. Let's face it. That's going to be our new doctrine. We'll put that on our church sign. Life is a crapshoot. All you foolish enter here. If you want to figure out how to handle the crapshoot, come here. Well, 18, there is a point at which human beings must accept their limitations, recognizing that one cannot straighten what God has bent. There's a certain level at which God controls this, and it doesn't matter what you do. And of course, this should help believers to faith rest things. Okay, God's in control. There's certain points at which I can't change it. Well, 19, the world is bent because of the curse that was placed on it at the fall of man, Genesis 3, 17 and 18, we saw that. And Romans 8, 20, the world has been subjected to futility, not of its own choice, but because of him who subjected it. While mankind is bent due to the indwelling sin nature. Romans 7, 13, all these verses give Paul's personal testimony, we might say, with respect to his battle against the STA. The sin nature. Romans 7:13. Therefore, did that which is good, i.e. the law of God. The law, he confesses, is perfect and righteous and good and just. Become a cause of death for me. May it never be. Rather, it was the sin nature. In order that it might be demonstrated to be sinful. By effecting my death through that which is good. So that through the commandment, the sin nature would be demonstrated to be utterly sinful. And you are morally bent. I am morally bent. We have fundamental problems. All of us. Some are more obvious than others. Some men's sins are obvious. They precede them to the judgment. Other men's follow along behind them. But guess what? They both got the problems. The human race is morally at fault. It's got fundamental problems. Verse 18, for I know that nothing dwells in me, that is in my flesh. That's where the sin nature resides. For the willing is present in me, I want to do right, but the doing of the good is not. And the believer goes through this sort of almost psychotic go-rounds with the STA, because you know when you sin, it doesn't work out for you. But we do it anyway. Why do we sin? I like the Fundies. Their approach is, if once you're saved, you won't want to sin. Oh, hell. I'm in trouble. I must not be saved. You won't want to sin. Paul talks about, I want to sin. He said, I want to do good, and I don't get it done because of my sin nature. And so you beat yourself up, and you ask yourself, why did I do that? That was stupid. I knew it was stupid. Ever been through that? Yeah. And every day, you'll find, you know, it may not happen every day, but the fact is, it'll be an ongoing thing in your Christian life. You'll let yourself down because you'll engage under the sin nature. And you'll know better in many cases. Now, sometimes it sneaks up on us. We're not watching. But a lot of times, we know better. I'm tempted to do this. I know it's not right. But I want to do it. It'll make me happy. No, it won't. There's the battle going on, the internal battle between the sin nature and the resident doctrine and the inner man. And then you're the moderator of all this. These two sides fighting it out. And you make the choice. That's where volition lies with you. I find the principle, verse 21, that evil is present in me, the one who wants to do good. For I joyfully concur with the law of God in the inner man. Resident doctrine tells me God's ways are right. I know that. That much I can figure out. But I see a different law in the members of my body, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of the sin nature which is in my members. And when he starts using this term law, it's because he's telling you the same thing happens every time. It's a law. It's like the law of gravity. I can throw that pen up a million times and it's going to do the same thing every time. It's going to go up and it's going to come down. And the reality is it's a law. It's an immutable law. There's an immutable law that deals with the sin nature as well. And the sin nature always leads to death. It's always the same thing. Never ever leads anywhere else. And verse 24, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from the body of this death? Why? Because the body's dead because of the sin nature. Talk about dead man walking. That's all of us. And the only thing, the only life we have, of course, is the eternal life of God that resides within us. So mankind is bent. Well, let me tell you something. You can't unbend the STA. It is what it is. It is perverse. Yours isn't the same as mine. You have your areas of weakness. I got mine. But the fact is, it is what it is. And you're not going to change it. And you're not going to beat it. So these human viewpoint programs of pull up your bootstraps, keep a stiff upper lip, all that. You can change yourself. How to change yourself into a better person. That's going to be good. I'd like to see that program. People don't become better persons. They may simply learn to moderate the expression of their sin nature. Or in many cases, it's really not their area of weakness. You see unbelievers out there that don't have areas of weakness in terms of sexual lust or drinking or all of these things or gambling, all that. You see them and they might appear righteous on the surface. Are they righteous? No. Absolutely not. They're engaged under the sin nature 24/7. But they look good because they don't have certain areas of weakness. So the sin nature is bent. Mankind is bent. The world is a bent place. And you're not going to straighten it out. There's a crusader arrogance of people. I'm going to change the devil's world. Good luck on that one. How long are you going to have to do it? How are you going to change it? The Pat Robertson approach through politics? The moral majority, what are the rest of us, the immoral minority? Well, I don't see that he's been successful with his goofy stuff. I don't see that any of these people fall well. I don't see Billy Graham's approach changing this world. And I see them all as being, in fact, failures into their approach of this because they aren't dealing with the real issues. And that gets into dealing with the lies of believers and their sin nature and what God wants. So 20, therefore, while what Solomon advises here is against the excessive pursuit of righteousness or endless that may commend itself to certain people, but does not commend itself and doesn't commend one to God. 21, the type of person that seeks to become overly righteous may be characterized by an exaggerated view of his own self-importance. Disdain for others that are not as righteous, and constant critiques and judgments on other believers. Luke 18, for instance, gives an example of this. Luke 18, 9 through 14. "And And he told this parable to some people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. This person always looks at you like this. They got to look down their nose at you to let you know. You're not righteous, and they are. And two men went up to the temple to pray. One a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. Well, the tax collectors were the hated segment of society, and everybody would have disdained them and said, oh, the tax collectors. They didn't. Matthew was one of those. Jesus picked him as one of the 12, and Matthew was a tax collector. He was not well-liked, trust me. They didn't make him treasurer, you notice that? He was good with money. Hell, that was his job. Now, they made Judas a tax collector. See, Judas looked good on the surface, didn't he? Of course he did. He had all the disciples snowed. Not one of them saw through him. Not till after the fact. Now, the Pharisee stood and was thus praying with himself. And this is what happens with the self-righteous person, particularly the unbeliever. He's not praying to God. He's praying with himself. His prayers get about to the bottom of his nose, and that's where they stop, as they come out of his mouth. God, I mean, I'm sure he said this in a booming voice. I thank you that I am not like other people. Man, I am something. Swindlers, unjust, adulterers, all the shocking sins, of course. He doesn't mention self-righteous here, though, interestingly enough. Or even like this filthy tax collector. And I'm sure tax collector was said with a good deal of disdain. I fast twice a week. I'm overtly squeaky clean. I pay tithes of all that I get. But the tax collector, standing some distance away, was unwilling even to lift his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, God, be merciful. And the word here actually is God. It's the word for mercy seat. God, be a mercy seat. I need a mercy seat. Be a mercy seat for me, the sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified, i.e. declared righteous, rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted. So, again, the type of person that wants to be overly righteous has weird views of people, has weird views of himself, in fact, distorted views. Because he's pursuing a righteousness that, one, isn't even commanded by the Scriptures. This type of person, again, is very often focuses on the overt and not the realities. And that's what he talked about here, the overt. I fast. He doesn't talk about internal realities of truth, love, justice, peace, all those things. He doesn't focus on that. He doesn't talk about the mental attitude sins, lust, pride, greed, anger, hatred, bitterness, all these things. He doesn't even mention those. Why? Because on the surface, he's clean. 24/7, he's under his STA. He's filthy before God, and he's spiritually dead, and God's not even listening to his prayer. But he walked away feeling justified. But who was really justified? The one who recognized who he was. He had an accurate view of himself. The Pharisee had no accurate view of himself. Okay, well, our time's up. We'll have to stop there, and we will continue on with this next Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen.